the consultants have this thing, well, it's okay, well, we'll tell you what to do and charge you a lot of money for it, but if it doesn't go right, it's not our fault. So as a consultant, as a sounding board working with C-suite individuals, theoretically, the reason they brought you in is because you have some good advice to give them. Right? Obviously, they need some help. They need some advice. They need some direction, because if they didn't, they wouldn't have called you in.
Hey there, welcome back. My name is Jeff Barnes, and I am your host today for the Angels Exits and Acquisitions podcast. And we just had Tom Cresti on the call today talking about leadership and growing businesses through acquisition, acquiring companies, investing in companies, and also what it takes to raise capital, even if you're already in a large organization. So I think you'll really enjoy this episode. A lot of great gems and nuggets here. So as always, do us a favor, subscribe to the podcast. Make sure you share this if you had some great insights here, and I look forward to hearing about your comments.
Welcome to Angels Exits and Acquisitions, the place to learn how to fund, scale, exit, and massively profit as an angel investor or entrepreneur. Brought to you by the Angel Investors Network. And now, here's your host, Jeff Barnes.
All right, welcome back to another episode of Angels Exits and Acquisitions. My name is Jeff Barnes, and I'll be your host today. And today we are talking to Tom Cresti, who has an interesting career of raising capital, acquiring businesses, and having a very long tenure and helping a lot of entrepreneurs with growth and raising capital and leadership. So Tom, welcome to the podcast today.
Jeff, thanks so much for having me. Look forward to our discussion.
Yeah, absolutely. I appreciate you being here. Now, before we click to record today, you were talking about how you essentially started a lot of your career in raising capital in a very unique way that I think a lot of people may not be familiar with. I have a little bit of familiarity with it, but I'd love for you to give people just a background of who you are and what you've done throughout your career, and then talking a little bit about the entrepreneurship model that you were mentioning to me.
Yeah, so the first two thirds of my career were working for large organizations, Fortune 100, Fortune 500s, probably the first 5 or 6 years were not really relevant because I was doing lower level manager tasks. And then, you know, as I started to raise in the, what I call the corporate food chain, I became an expat. And then once I became an expat, it became very relevant to start raising capital. What I mentioned to you is look, raising capital is the same process, whether you're an entrepreneur starting a company and going on, you know, in Silicon Valley or Wall Street trying to find money for company, or you going in front of a bunch of executive VPs who hold the budgets and allocate money for you. That first experience was when I started up an organization in Eastern Europe, and literally back in 1991, 1992, I had a rental car, I had a phone that was the size of my briefcase, and I started a company from scratch. And, you know, probably about 6 months after that, I had to go back to, some higher level corporate executives that said, okay, well, over the next 2 or 3 years, we're going to lose about $1.5 to $2 million. So basically I was looking for an investment of about $2 million. And I had to convince some higher ups in the organization to say, look, my journey and my idea of losing $1.5 to $2 million until I build a business, is a better idea than somebody else in the organization who wants the same $2 million to do something else. So I had to, you know, paint a vision for them. I had to paint a picture for them to say, okay, well, you know, in that, you know, 5 year horizon, we'll get to about 12 million. But it's going to take, you know, first year and a half, we're going to lose in marketing and other, you know, building products. It's going to lose about $1.5 million. And I was able to convince them. And then probably about 3 years later, part of their growth was, you know, I identified a local company that we could buy. That was a local brand that we can purchase, and there was a local manufacturing facility that we can purchase. So that was about another $2.5 or $3 million that we're paying for that. So I had to go back to the kitty again and say, okay, well, never mind the $1.5 million that you already gave me. You know, I need another $2.5 to $3 million to buy this local company. And again, I had to convince them to do that. And we did. And lo and behold, after, you know, 4 or 5 years, we were at $12 million in net sales and a profitable company. And then, you know, as I rose in the corporate food chain, that equation just got bigger, you know, so instead of asking for $2 million, we're asking for $25 million. You know, instead of 25 million, we were asking for 95 million. So it was just a scale. It was just a scale that was getting much bigger.
Yeah, absolutely. And I love that too, because when I got started in the corporate world, you know, just like you, start really low on the food chain and then eventually, you know, scaling up the ladder. And I got to a point where we were doing something very similar. We were looking for technology and innovation projects, and these, you know, budding entrepreneurs and tech companies from all over the world that were looking for capital. And so they were not anywhere near the operational capabilities of a Fortune 500 business, but they had the technology we needed. And so to use their technology, we either needed to acquire them, partner with them, or invest in them to get them to the level we could help. And so it was the same thing, right? You have to go in front of the C-suite or the board, and you have to talk to them, and you have to build your case, and then you have to give a presentation. And you're right. Even though you might be competing or working in an organization that has, you know, hundreds of millions, billions of dollars to invest, you're still having to compete with everybody else inside that business who is looking for that same capital, which is very similar to every entrepreneur going after every investor that they can find and competing with them, not only with every other entrepreneur raising capital, but also with the banks and the stock market and everything else, right? So there's a lot of corollaries when it comes to raising capital. And one of the things that one of my early bosses mentioned to me and kind of made my skin crawl the very first time I had heard it, she said, you need to get really good at sales. I said, but I'm an engineer. I'm a tech guy. What do you mean I have to get good at sales? I'm not going to go out and start selling. She goes, every single day you are selling yourself or you're selling your ideas to everybody else who's about to raise capital or invest in you. So if you don't get good at this, you will not succeed. Did you ever have a similar experience or an eye-opening moment like that?
Well, look, everything starts with sales. I think in any sales cycle and any conversation people have, I always encourage them to look at it this way, that the person on the opposite end of your table is asking them three questions. Right? So they ask themselves these same three questions. And the first question is, do you care for me? Right. So is this person on the other side of the table actually care about what I think, about what my needs are, what I want? So if I'm an investor, you know, do you really care about what it's in it for me as an investor? Right. So do you care for me is an extremely important question, because that requires active listening and active listening to say, okay, what is that person? You know, what's their pressure points? You know, what makes them tick? And then the second question is, can you help me? Right. So then it's really taking your pitch, because you're not going to come up with a new pitch for every investor. I mean, your pitch is your pitch. But what you have to do is, after you have that active listening session, and you put yourself in that person's shoes, now you're positioning your proposition with benefits to that individual, right? So you're still selling the same thing, but the way you're positioning it is through the benefit statement that addresses all those needs that you just found out. And then the third question is, can you trust me? And you have to build trust with that individual that, you know, when they give you $100,000 or $1 million or whatever it is, you know, you're not going to Vegas and gamble and get away, but you're actually going to have a rate of return for them that you promised them. So trust is a very big issue. And, you know, you have to do that fairly quickly. So in any sales conversation, I think that's the three questions I always encourage people to ask, you know, not, you know, ask themselves that, you know, how do I answer those questions? Because that's really what's in the other guy person's mind on the other end. And if you can answer those questions, you know, rightly so, then you can build the trust. And that doesn't guarantee that you're going to get an investor. But I can guarantee you that if you don't answer those three questions properly, you will not get an investor.
Yeah, no doubt about it, right? And I love those points, because we always talk about, you know, the radio station with them, right? What's in it for me? And we try to, when we're coaching entrepreneurs and talking to people about raising capital, they need to remember, it's not about your product. It's not about your service. It's not about how great you are, your technology. It's about the person on the other side of the table, the person on the other side of that presentation that's listening to you. They want to know, what's in it for me. And, you know, some of them, you know, when we talk about impact investing as an example, everybody will say, well, we're doing a great thing for humanity and for society. Well, that's wonderful. But if the person you're talking to only cares about a return, then you're talking to the wrong audience, right? And we always have to explain that to folks, that they need to really think about who they are pitching to and then target them and go after the right people. And of course, give that presentation. So I love that you bring that up, because most people only want to talk about how great their technology is, how great their offer is. And they wonder why at the end of the day, they pitched 100 people and 100 got 100 no's, right? Or 100 come back to me when you're ready and you're further along and things like that. And they just can't understand why people aren't taking them seriously or why people aren't getting. So I love that you put those three points out there, that you know, the active listening is really important, understanding what those other people want and what's in it for them. And do we care about what they want? Because if you don't hit those points, you're right, then they don't feel like they're going to add any value. Even if they have the capital to invest, they don't feel like they'll add value or that they're even, you know, heard well enough to be a part of your organization.
And the other thing that I'm very high on is, as you're putting together your pitch deck and you're actually pitching to individuals, you know, a lot of people, especially in technology, get so hung up on their technology that, you know, that's what their focus is. You know, mm-hmm. I've got this technology and it does this and that. And they forget that the audience on the other side may not be a tech guru, because after all, your technology may be so unique that nobody really understands it. Right. So when you put your pitch together, I always encourage people to say, look, simplify it and answer four questions. What, why, how, and who? All right. So first of all, even before you go into the room, know who's in the room, because you may have 10 people in a room, but maybe only one person has the authority to sign the check, you know, but there's two other people in the room who are influencers. They can't sign the check, but you know, they can go to bat for you and they can influence the guy that actually signs the check. Right. Or maybe there's a person in that room that has resources that you can draw on. Again, they can't sign your check, but they may be a you know, technological sounding board for you or some other resource that can provide for you. So understand who is in the room before you ever walk into the room, so you understand how to address those people. And then, you know, the first question you kind of open up is, what is your big idea? Just a simple one sentence. This is my big idea. And then what is at stake if your idea doesn't materialize? And what is the benefit if it does materialize, right? So start talking emotionally to the people in the room. Just don't talk about facts. Don't talk about figures, but start, you know, start that process of pulling all those heartstrings on those emotional things, right? And personal stories are great. And many, you know, I teach this all the time for folks. Look, you know, don't talk about what's on your slides. Let the slides talk to themselves and illustrate the information on those slides through either your stories or other people's stories. So again, answer that question, what, and then answer the question, why. Okay. So what is this great thing that you want to do? And why do you want to do it? And why should those people be interested in, right? And then how is the nitty gritty, you know, that's the, your secret sauce, you know, that's what's making you different. That's what's making you unique. So that's all the, you know, bells and whistles. And, you know, unfortunately, most people, when they pitch, 99% of their stuff is in the how. You know, they forget about the what and why. So yeah. start with the picture, what, why, and get people's emotion involved. And the best way to do that is through personal stories. And I've spoken to people who are, you know, pitching for major business. I mean, you know, talking about a couple of hundred, you know, million dollars. And they had a string of personal stories on what and why they were doing it to really get people emotional, because people in the room are people. So you're going to appeal to them through their emotions. People don't buy on facts. People buy on emotions supported by facts.
Yeah, exactly. That old adage, facts tell, but stories sell, right? And if we can't get to those emotional triggers, we're never going to get to the logical justification of their buying response, right? As people say, you know, people will justify their purchase with logic, but they buy because of the emotion, right? And so the same thing's true for investing. And I would say the same thing's true, you know, obviously when you're raising capital, but if you've talked about acquiring businesses, right? And I'd imagine that there's, whenever you're acquiring business, you were talking about the one earlier, where it's like an add-on to what you're already doing, there's a logical reason for that. But I'd imagine there's, you know, an emotional justification for an acquisition of a company as well. It's not just, hey, you know, X plus Y equals Z, we're going to do this. But why would we go after one company versus another for an acquisition target, things like that? Do you ever apply that same kind of logic when you're on the flip side and you are buying a company that's already existing? Maybe they're not looking for capital, but you guys want to invest in them or acquire them?
Well, absolutely. I'm sorry, I'm dating myself here, but you know, back in the 70s, I mean, Wall Street was just buying up everything. So you end up with companies that had no logic buying certain, you know, other companies, but they were just buying companies for the sake of buying companies. So, you know, one of the companies that I worked for was Colgate-Palmolive. I started working for them right out of college. And when I started working for them, they had a portfolio of companies that included personal care, which is, you know, their best, their bread and butter, but they were in crystal. They were in, pharmaceuticals. They were in golf clubs. They were, you know, like all over the place. Sara Lee was another company. You know, they were in coffee, foods, and pantyhose and everything else. So, you know, understand what you're good at and what you love to do and what's your, you know, what they call the core competencies, your core brands, and purchase around that. Don't just go buy things for the sake of buying them. You know, make sure that they fit for you strategically. So you got to have a very strong vision, a very strong strategy for your company. To say, okay, what is going to complement my growth, my vision, my strategy, and this particular company, is that going to complement my growth? And you know, any given company, you've got some stuff that you know it's generating a lot of cash right now. It's really attractive, and you got some stuff that you're betting on in the future. So if you're making acquisitions, don't buy acquisitions in the category that you're already generating a bunch of cash in, right? Buy acquisitions that help you your strategic stuff, right? So if you're looking down and say, look, I'm building something that's going to kind of start making money in 5 years. Well, okay, that's a place you look for acquisitions. If you say, look, I'm already churning cash on this one particular category or this particular product, you don't need to buy anything there, right? So just think about what you want to buy.
And, you know, along those lines, you know, I'm sure Harvard Business Review is littered with all these case studies of, you know, companies that bought, you know, or acquired another company because of the potential synergistic effects, right? And for whatever reason, they didn't come to fruition. And one of my favorite examples right now is a company called Thrasio. They raised $3 billion through private equity as part of a e-commerce roll-up process. And within 3 years, they're filing bankruptcy, right? And it's just amazing. How do you raise that much money and then start filing for bankruptcy? It's like, it's unheard of. But then you look at it, you're like, okay, well, you know, somebody who's been in those businesses probably bought it because we thought we could do this. We thought we could roll these things all together. We'd have the synergistic effect and we'd compound our value. And lo and behold, hey, there's actual people that run these companies and the cultures may not align. And the software that we're using on this platform versus this platform is a nightmare. And it's going to take, you know, so there's a lot of other hidden issues, I'd say, when it comes to the acquisition side of a business. And I love that you say that, you know, don't go buy a business that you're already in necessarily. Yeah, there might be a couple of cases where that makes sense, but buy the business that's going to maybe bolt on and add value to what you're already doing or a direction you want to go or things like that. So how do you, you know, when you're looking at these companies, I know you've done a number of them, how do you guys put that filter on or that lens on that says, is this in the direction we want to go? And does it start with a vision at the very beginning with the chairman of the board and the board of directors saying, okay, the vision of our umbrella company, our overall company is this. And then you look for the pieces to bolt that into, or is there a different approach?
No, absolutely. You have to have a very strong vision, a compelling vision for your organization and for your company. And vision is not something that's a 3-year plan or 5-year plan. Vision is something that's way out in the future. You know, if you look at two different companies, right? One is Puma, one is Nike. One says we want to unleash human potential, that's Nike, and Puma says we want to be the fastest brand on earth. Right? So if those vision statements, you know, they're both in the athletic apparel industry, right? But if you just listen to those vision statements, the acquisitions that they're going to make is going to be very different, right? So you don't really see Nike making Formula One driving shoes, but that's one of Puma's main categories, right? Because they want to be the fastest, you know, brand on earth. So when you're acquiring companies, again, have a vision and a vision, you know, if you're going to be the fastest brand on earth, that's not a vision that's a two or three. Okay, now we're the fastest brand on earth. And that's, you know, let's think of a different vision. No, you go down that road and you can pursue a strategy that allows you to grow in that area. So have a clear vision. And then like any large company or any small company, really, you have to have a 3-year strategy. You know, the communist countries said, oh, we're what's smarter than capitalism. We're going to have a 5-year strategy, right? So they had the communist 5-year plan. But like 3 years is a pretty good snapshot where you can look out 3 years into the future and have some form of predictability. And then, you know, every year you lock in your operating budget, which is year one of your strategic plan. That becomes your operating budget for that year. And then, you know, when operating budgets come around next year, they look at the strategy and forecast it one more year out and lock in your next year's operating plan. So, you know, you kind of look at that and say, okay, well, if 3 years from now, and I don't know what, you know, a specific company is, but if you say, look, 3 years from now, I want to be a major player in a certain category that gets me along that vision. And again, I don't know Puma for nothing, but, you know, if Puma says, okay, well, you know, we already have the fastest running shoes because we got, you know, a guy like Usain Bolt wearing our shoes, and we already have the fastest Formula One, shoes. You know, maybe I've got the fastest shoes that sit in a rocket ship. I don't know, because the rocket ships are fast, right? So then if that's my vision, that I'm the fastest brand on earth, then I'm going, you know what? We're going to enter the aerospace industry in 3 years. So let's start looking at companies that we can potentially acquire in apparel that work in the aerospace industry. So you start looking at that, and then, you know, 3 years from now, you maybe buy one, or maybe 2 years from now, you know, it comes up. So you kind of look at strategic fits, and you also have to look at values, right? The other thing people mistake is a lot of acquisitions go bad, not necessarily because the acquisition was bad, but they overpaid for it. And it fell apart, right? So when you're looking at acquisitions, the other thing that you have to have a very strong discipline on is don't justify the acquisitions on synergies, right? Justify the acquisitions only on sales. What does it bring into your sales table, right? Now, absolutely, you want to roll things together. You want to basically harvest those synergies, but you don't want to plan for them. Because if they don't materialize, then your whole financial model that you put together to justify purchasing that company falls apart. So just only justify it on sales. And if the numbers work on sales, it's probably something that you should think about very strongly. And yeah, absolutely. You know, take all the synergies all day, but don't plan on them.
And how do you feel core competencies fall into that, right? Because as I'm listening to you, you're talking about the Puma, we want to be the fastest brand on earth. You know, we might talk about all these different verticals where speed is of the essence, right? Well, they might not go into like the horseshoe business, right? They're probably not going to put shoes on horses because that's not what they do, but they might want to put the shoes on the jockeys, right? Something like that. And what I feel when I'm, you know, reading through businesses that failed through acquisition, what I'm seeing is that there was a lack of core competency alignment, or somebody saying, like you were saying, Sara Lee, okay, we're in all these different foods. Let's go into the pantyhose business too, right? Because, you know, women like to eat our food and they also want to wear pantyhose. Like, I don't know what their thought process was there, but I feel like that's, we see that in hindsight, we're like, why would you do that? Right? It doesn't make any sense. But there was some justification for doing it in the first place. So what are your thoughts on when it comes to core competency and alignment?
Well, core competency basically means that you can support or you can kind of digest that acquisition, right? So if I'm a pharmaceutical company, you know, for me to buy a software company, you know, it's a stretch, right? Because I don't have a core competency in software. I have a core competency in, you know, bioengineering. I have a core competency in chemistry. I have a core competency in some other stuff, but I probably don't have a core competency in software. So I would ask that question, okay, if I'm in pharmaceuticals, why do I buy a software company? So there has to be some alignment on what you're good at. And core competencies are those things that I described that you don't farm out, right? They're your core competencies, you know? So if you're a marketing company, for example, you know, you don't really farm out your marketing. You hire the best marketing people, and that's your core competency. If you're a sales company, that's, you know, you're not going to farm out sales. That's going to be your core competency. You know, if you're an accounting company, you're going to, you know, if you're a CPA firm, you're going to surround yourself with the best CPAs. You're not farming that out. So, you know, understand you're 100% right. Understand what your core competencies are and stay within that parameter.
That's awesome. So, Tom, we've been talking a lot about, you know, the investing and the acquisitions and the business growth through acquisitions as well. You know, we haven't really mentioned that word specifically, but that's why you would do a lot of this stuff. And I've been listening to what you're saying and hearing how you're talking through this. And it sounds like you've probably had a lot of experience working with CEOs and, you know, board members and things like that to help them through this process as well, right? And I know you've written a book on this, so I'd love to learn a little bit more about, and I know the audience would too, is like, how do you help people when it comes to that sort of stuff, like making these sorts of decisions and whatnot? And then tell us a little bit about the C-suite and beyond.
Well, you know, you help leaders because of you want to, I guess, give them some, you know, direction, but also give them some discipline. Right. So you're kind of a sounding board and consultants are, I don't like the word of definition consultants because I've worked with a lot of consultants, when I was working for larger organizations and, you know, they come and say, okay, well, here's what you should do. And I'm going to charge you a couple of $1 million for all the stuff that you have to do. And if you get it right, hey, kudos to me. If you get it wrong, well, you didn't follow my strategy. Right? So it's, you know, your consultants have this thing, well, it's okay. Well, we'll tell you what to do and charge you a lot of money for it. But if it doesn't go right, it's not our fault. As a consultant, as a sounding board working with C-suite individuals, theoretically, the reason they brought you in is because you have some good advice to give them. Right? Obviously, they need some help. They need some, advice. They need some direction. Because if they didn't, they wouldn't have called you in, right? So they're asking those questions there. And again, it comes to kind of that listening to say, okay, you know, do you care for me? So as a consultant, you go in and say, okay, well, you know, why did you call me in? Okay, you're doing the acquisition. Why are you so hesitant about the acquisition? And give them that roadmap, because once you've been through it a couple of times or several times, you can help them with that roadmap. Right? We had a very large global merger between Reckitt and Reckitt Coleman and Bankiser. At that time, I was working for Bankiser, and it was an interesting global merger. It was one of the largest global mergers in the household cleaning industry and in the consumer household cleaning industry. And, you know, we are trying to merge two very, very large corporations together. And we brought in a consulting firm who I will not name. That charged us, you know, close to $2 million, put in a bunch of, you know, people to help us and just, you know, really like simple stuff, you know, like, okay, you've got two companies, you're both selling to the same customers. So what are you going to do within a very short period of time, within 30 days, you have to figure out how you're going to show one face to the customer because the customers are going to play you, right? They're going to say, hey, well, you know, Company A is giving me 60-day terms. You guys are giving me 30-day terms. So I want the 60-day terms. And Company B is giving me 20% discount. You're only giving me 10% discount. So I want the 20% discount with the 60-day terms, right? So how are you going to face that customer in 30 days as one new company, right? So, yeah, it's a difficult kind of stuff, but it's a pretty simple logic, right? And if you have two companies in one country, how are you going to consolidate two factories into one? How are you going to consolidate two management teams into one? I mean, just really simple, straightforward stuff. But, you know, they kind of just gave us a roadmap of things to think about. We still had to implement them. They didn't do it for us. We had to do it and charge us a lot of money for it. Right. So, that's why they call you in. And that's why I talk to C-suite people, because they obviously they have a question, or they want maybe just, you know, endorsement of what they're thinking about, what they're doing makes sense because you have that past experience.
So would you say then that, you know, consultants are generally hired to come in because hopefully they have a lot of expertise and deep knowledge in a certain space and hopefully teams to help maybe not necessarily implement, because like you said, they don't always implement the work or do the work for you, but they can ingest a lot of information and then build out a roadmap or a plan and present that plan and give you guys that information. Like, I feel like that's what a consultant generally does. And they might even suggest different technologies or softwares you might use or ways about building something. But then what you're referring to is more of like that advisor role where somebody hires you and they want to bring you in. Yeah, you have the expertise and you have, you know, that deep knowledge as well, but you're there to ask the questions and maybe even challenge the thought process a little bit and have them think, have these C-suite leaders think through that process before implementing what they believe to be the best course of action.
Yeah, look, in an ideal world, if I was a CEO and I was looking to buy a company, in an ideal world, I would not bring in a consultant after I bought the company. I would bring in that consultant that has the know-how and can give me the advice even before I ever pull the trigger, right? Right. So, and then once I pull the trigger, you know, have them guide me through the process of you know, merging the integration of the two companies together. So, yeah.
I had this, and when I was working at corporate America, we had this gentleman come in and speak to us who had gotten paid a speaking fee to come in and speak to us about things that we were working through. And he's also hired as a consultant for us. He literally said, he's on stage and he's talking about this. And he goes, it's kind of funny that people hire me to be a consultant because all I do is I come in, and then I go and I interview all the people that have been the loudest and the noisiest about what should be done in a company. And then I take all that stuff and I put it into a nice little pretty format and I present it to the C-suite. And they're like, yeah, these are great ideas. Of course, let's implement that. He goes, it doesn't make any sense. I was like, man, the cojones on this guy, because he's talking to the same audience that just hired him to do that exact same thing. I was like, well, it's, but you know, sometimes the leadership will listen to an outside voice sooner than they'll listen to an inside voice, I find, unfortunately. But I thought it was kind of funny how he summed it up. Being a consultant is easy. You just listen to the people that already have all the good ideas, and then you just present them to the board.
No, look, at the end of the day, there's not that many new ideas out there. It's really, you know, the winners are the ones that actually look at an idea that's already existing out there and say, okay, how do I apply this to my situation? Because the idea is there, but maybe in my market, nobody ever thought about it. Right. So, you know, how do I apply it to me and how do I make that successful? Same thing with mergers and acquisitions. I mean, there's not a whole lot of new ideas about merger and acquisitions out there, right? Just, you know, take a look at if your framework and what you're trying to do with the acquisition and how it would apply to you. It's not like you're reinventing the wheel every time.
Yeah, I'm glad you took it that direction, because I was going to say the same thing. Is like, you know, if we're talking about acquiring businesses and scaling up companies through acquisition, you know, there's a whole history of case studies around, you know, successful mergers and acquisitions, failed M&As, you know, things that went really well for a little while and then fell apart. And there's just a lot to be learned from that. And I find that a lot of times the smart people, or the people who even think they're the smartest, want to reinvent the wheel. And I find that the people who are the best leaders do everything they can to avoid reinventing the wheel.
Now, you know, it's true. And he's talked about core competencies before. So, you know, I worked for a company at one time, and, you know, we were not in the same league as the Krafts or the Sara Lees or the Procter and Gambles of the world. You know, those were large fish. So we're not in the same league. And we had a consolidation strategy where we were buying companies in emerging markets. Not huge companies, you know, usually in a neighborhood between 25 and 50 million. And what I realized is we don't have the same strength as these large companies to buy a company and send our team in there to start running it, right? Because that's the ideal. That's why you're buying this company, because you want to kind of integrate them into your organization. But what we did have was we had a whole boatload of really good accountants, right? So we were very successful in buying companies in emerging markets because we understood what our strength and what our weaknesses was. So our weakness was we didn't have a management team to go in and take over this company, but our strength was we had great accountants. So there was at least three companies that we were speaking with that was up for sale, as were our competitors like Kraft and Sara Lee and others. And we ended up buying them for a very simple reason. Those companies came to the local NOLA and said, look, you know, Jeff, we love your company. You've done a great job building this company. We'd like to buy 100%. If you cancel us 100%, we want to start at 51. And within 3 years, we have an exit mechanism by that you're out within. And from day one, we bring our own team in. All right. We came in and we said, Jeff, look, you know, we got a different ideas. You know, we'll start off with 50-50. We won't even want to budget. You know, we're not going to take a minority, but if you want to start 50-50, because this is your gem, this is your jewel, this is what you worked all your life to build, we're okay with that. We'll start 50. You know, in fact, we want you to remain and run the company because we think you're that good. We have one criteria. We want to send a CFO in. So the guy that, you know, is the CFO of the company has to be ours. But, you know, you did a great job building it, so you continue to build it. And when you're ready to sell, you sell. Right? And we won every time. Because, you know, these folks, they built their business. They didn't have to get kicked out on day one, right? And they were remained in. They were able to run the organization. And we just watched the kitty, right? So it was a pretty simple formula, just understanding what our competences was and what our competitors were doing. And it worked.
I love that idea. You know, and that's honestly something that hadn't really entirely crossed my mind when we're looking at various acquisitions is, you know, we talk about buying portions of companies and keeping people on and having an earn out. A lot of the times that companies we're working with, folks want to sell because they're ready to be done, but we always need a transition period, right? But I love that idea of those companies that, you know, they want to continue building and being in it, but there is a core competency you need to install to feel safe with that long-term growth and acquisition strategy. So I think that's a goldmine right there.
And not only that, I mean, without failure, every one of those owners sold. Right. So,
yeah,
you know, it was the end result was the same. We just didn't bully them up front. Right. Within 5 years, they all sold anyway, because they also saw and they got a much higher multiple for it as well. Right. Because they helped continue to grow the business. And in any merger and acquisitions, there's a danger that when you buy a business or you merge with a business, you bring your own people in, things don't go as well as you think they would go. And the business takes a hit.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, managing that process can be a real challenge for a lot of folks, especially if they've never gone through it before. So wonderful.
Yep.
Tom, I really appreciate your time today. Thank you so much for being here. You know,
sure.
We didn't really even get into your book too much, but I'd love to have you tell people a little bit more about where they can find you, connect with you, and, you know, reach out to you.
I'm blessed and cursed with a last name that you had trouble pronouncing. So, you know, the fact is if you, you know, go to LinkedIn and you look at Caresti, you find me and my two daughters, right? If you go to Amazon and you search for Caresti, you'll find me, nobody else. So the book is C-Suite and Beyond, and it's just a collection of stories when I was an expat living and working all over the world. It's some personal stories about family, about kids, about business, mergers and acquisitions, building brands, all kinds of other stuff. So I call it the Four Keys to Leadership Success. So C-Suite and Beyond, Four Keys to Leadership Success. And you know, Google Caresti and you'll find me. There's not a lot of Carestis out there.
Awesome. And we'll make sure we put all those links in the show notes. So if you're watching this or listening to it while you're driving, just make sure to take a look at the show notes afterwards. But Tom, thank you so much for being here. I really appreciate it. For those of you who are watching and listening still, make sure you subscribe, like, and share this episode and share this message out with as many people as you can. Especially if you got great value out of this. Again, you've been listening to the Angels, Exits, and Acquisitions podcast from Angel Investors Network. Thank you.